Folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life, if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, February the 26th, 2026. Two six. My little sideline autism just caught that numeric pattern. Anyway, this is episode, again, 3807. It's a Thursday, so it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show. And I've got a really interesting, diverse lineup of stuff for you today. First of all, conspicuous by their absence, Chris Rossini, Dan McAdams, and Dr. Ron Paul will not be with us today, or I believe next week. But that's a lot because they're not hanging out with us no more. It's simply because Chris Rossini is taking a well-deserved vacation, finally, and going to hang out in a cool place. So he's the one that does all the work for us over there, getting us our segments. So he's off, so they don't happen. I got a shout-out for Nick Ferguson today. I'll tell you about that in just a second. Mike Melito is going to talk about one of my favorite things in the world, pistol-caliber carbines, but in this case from an optics standpoint. Joel Riles will talk about choosing a good dog breed for a hiking buddy and how to train your hiking buddy dog. Foraging for the amazing moral mushroom with Carrie Brown. Antonio Gatto will tell you what ice damming is and why you should give a damn. He did the ice damming thing. I did the why you should give a damn because I'm a marketer. Ryan Steva will talk about propane and when you're bringing like a very large propane tank, 500,000 size tank, should you lease it? Should you buy it? Which one is better and why? Matt Sersley will talk about, is there any way to make the purchase of a dog, like a protection dog from a guy like Joel Riles, tax deductible? He'll give you some ways to do it. And I have some additional thoughts because, well, I just like being creative with business and tax things. And there's a lot of ways that you can skin a cat, or in this case, maybe skin a dog deduction. But Matt gives some excellent advice and his very ending piece on it. What you would say to defend this if you did it is brilliant lawyer speak that you should memorize if you're going to do it. Anyway, and then my today will be, actually I'm just going to read a short email and comment on a bit. I'm calling this a master class in sustainable protein for almost zero ongoing cost. There would be a cost of setup, but the long-term ongoing cost of this would basically be free meat and eggs. Both are protein sources, forever. And it ain't got nothing to do with a chicken. I'll leave it at that. No, it's not an iguana farm. Those of you who have been paying attention to the falling iguanas out of the trees with Florida's recent freeze. And this is just a really cool way to do things, and it makes a lot of sense. And there's one real major input to it long term, and you can get it for free. And this guy gets it from work. And this is, I'm going to do this one as much for what he's doing with it as to, I never thought about that source for this particular input before. All right, with that, before we get into it, I do want to throw out a shout out to who should be our guest on Wednesday next week. And unless something in what I'm about to tell you preempts that, Nick Ferguson. I mentioned in a video recently. They're about to have their baby, their baby girl. It'll be baby number four, baby girl number one. They spent a day and a half at the hospital waiting for Katie to give birth. And I think they're sending her home, and which means she'll probably go home, get comfortable, and immediately have to go back to the hospital and finally actually give birth. So I guess, you know, they just wasn't time yet. And, you know, Nick said that sometimes women, when they're really amped up, will actually defer labor. It's like they don't do it on purpose, but innately, like it's a genetic thing or an intrinsic thing that if a woman somehow feels anxious about where they may be able to, with no real conscious thought, actually defer and delay the onset of full labor, and maybe that's what happened. If so, yeah, she's probably going to get completely comfortable at home, be like, we got to go back. Anyway, I brought that up only because I want to put a little impetus here for guys maybe to spend a little bit of money with Nick, because I said, man, you're about to have a baby. Are you sure you want to be on the air next week? He goes, man, those diapers don't buy themselves. And he's right in the middle of his big annual plant sale. And he's got a package. Like, some of the packages I put out are already sold out completely. But he's trying to liquidate everything as he does every year. And he's got a package of oaks. It's called the Oak Bonanza. It's three each of three different oaks, so nine oak trees, and it's about $70. If you've priced trees, you know that's a good deal. I don't remember all the oaks. I know one's a chestnut oak, and I think another one's a Sherman oak, but I'm not sure. But I have a link in the show notes for you today. He's going to be on the air Wednesday. We're going to talk about these trees. You know what's going to happen when we do. They're going to sell out. That's what's going to happen. By Thursday morning, they'll be gone. If you can think about your property and think, it'd be nice to have nine oak trees on my property, I can think of where I would put those. You might want to get these ordered before that happens, because it happens quite often. So that's a little shout out. Baby girl Ferguson is on the way, hopefully soon. And we need to, you know, help Nick out by, you know, not by throwing money at him or whatever, but let's do some business with him. He's got good stuff. And I'll also say there's some other stuff still available. Again, rareplantstore.com is the place. Go check it out. All right, now let's talk about something totally different. You get yourself one of them old PCCs. What is a PCC? Well, friends, that would be a pistol caliber carbine. I love these things. This is I think they're a love or hate it type of thing for a lot of people. Like, if you're going to have a long gun, why don't you just have like a 308 or a 223 or something? Because it's fun and because it's cool and because nobody asked you. Anyway, no, really, I love pistol caliber carbines. So everything from Rugers, which we're going to talk about today, to even like some of the Marlin lever guns, or the old Marlin Camp carbines were great. High point, low end, but really great piece of equipment, honestly. Ruger old Deerfield carbines, you can find them. I mean, you get what I'm saying. I like these Sub 2K from Keldec. I love it all. But I've never really been big on red dot optics on them. Though, if you're going to put an optic on one, that's probably the place for it. And some of these newer ones, I definitely would consider dropping an optic on. So someone asked Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Training about that. He's got some really great recommendations, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
What is going on, TSP? Let's talk about optics for a pistol caliber carbine in 45 ACP. Got a question here from a listener. It says he got a Ruger LC carbine in 45. Some details, he says, usage, home defense, varmints, and truck gun, and or get home bag, with more firepower than his typical EDC firearm. He also says that the options are overwhelming. That is one of the great things, guys. We live in a golden era of firearms, ammunition, and optics. But it can lead to some analysis paralysis. That said, I'm going to try to stick to three good recommendations, and there's probably 50 other ones. So just because I didn't mention yours doesn't mean it's not good. Okay. We are talking about a 45 caliber carbine here, pistol caliber carbine. This would really apply if you have a 9mm carbine or a 10mm carbine. What is important to note is there are two different layouts for optics for pistol caliber carbines. If it's set up like an M4 or an M16 with a straight stock, like a buffer tube design, even if it has no buffer tube, even if it has a folding stock, it's going to be set up so the optic is much higher than the barrel. The height above bore is going to be greater, which means you're going to have a different mounting style to be comfortable than you would on a traditional swept down stock. Like, this was a 45 long Colt lever action carbine. The optic itself, or if it has a detachable mount, is going to be far different in height. That is important, because if you have one of those other style of carbines with a swept down traditional stock, these recommendations will be different. His carbine is set up with a straight stock and backup iron sights, the flip up M4 style. So I'm going to give him recommendations that should work and co-witness which is a big deal to me. If it's for anything serious, which he mentioned, serious use, I like to have backup iron sights, and I like to have a co-witness. My philosophy on optics to take batteries are, I'll use it until it breaks, and then when it breaks, I'll take it off and use the iron sights. Because they're electronics. Electronics break. I don't care how long they say the battery life is. Those are under optimal conditions. If it gets crazy hot or so cold that it won't transmit, etc. Just think back in your life to every time you've had a computer or an electronic thing fail. And these have made giant strides in dependability, but they're still electronics. So, co-witness iron sights. The other big reason I like this is, if you go to pick it up and use it, you should be able to flip up your sights and look and make sure that that optic is still zeroed with a red dot sight. If it's not, you always confirm, but you can adjust it, co-witness it with your irons. You can slave it to the irons. Okay, a lot of talk, but I think important before we get into different optics. The first one I'm going to give you, and I'm going to try and remember to send links to all of these to Jack, so we can put it in his Amazon affiliate thing if he chooses to. The first one is going to be an American-made, high-quality, really rugged red dot sight. It's not the newest, it's not the most innovative. It's one of the reasons I picked it first, because it's rugged and reliable and proven. This is the Leupold RDS. Link I'm going to send has the mount included. You can get them without the mount if you're competent in your mounting ability. That's fine, save some money. There's different reticles. Get the one that you choose. Just a simple red dot for this kind of carbine is probably fine. If you're shooting longer distance, you'll probably just hold over. But they do make a BDC reticle, ballistic drop compensator. But a lot of times, if you're doing stuff fast, simpler is better. But the Leupold is an American-made company. It's an American-made red dot, which is sadly hard to find. Even a lot of traditional American companies have their red dots made overseas. But this one is a good, rugged, reliable American-made red dot. Talked about truck gun. Truck guns can take a beating sometimes. So that's my number one recommendation. It's not cheap. It's right around $400-ish. The next one is a Chinese optic, Holosun. As much as I'd hate to admit it, Holosun really kind of is the name to beat for affordable, innovative, good, pretty rugged optics. The one I'm going to recommend for this is the HS512C. It's a good red dot sight with solar-powered charging, which gives it a crazy long battery life. They're very rugged. I have an older version of this, which is on one of my go-to truck guns, which is an M4 clone. So I feel pretty comfortable recommending it to you for a truck gun optic. The mount's going to be included. Solar backup, shake awake. While not a cheap optic, you get a lot for your money there. Probably the best value. The next one I'm going to recommend, these have been around a long time. I've used these a long time. The Bushnell TRS-25. These are very affordable. They're also very rugged. I don't have any problem recommending them for putting on a shotgun or a 22 or this 45 caliber carbine. They're no frills. They're simple. Don't have a long battery life. If you forget to turn them off on your last range session, next time you go, they'll die. So if this is a serious use gun, get a couple of those watch batteries and put them in your range bag or in the bag with the gun, because that happens. But they're a cheap, affordable optic, and I don't know your budget, so I thought I'd recommend one. Bushnell TRS-25. I said three. I'm going to throw in a wild card here. I'm not going to give you a specific model, but there are prism sights. Prism sights are not the same as a red dot sight. Consider just a simple 1X scope. That's basically a prism sight. You can get it with magnification, but for this, I would say no magnification. They make them with illuminated reticle. So what's the difference between that and a red dot sight? Well, they have an etched reticle, meaning if the power goes out on the optic, it will just be a black reticle, like a scope on a traditional rifle scope. So that is something you may want to consider is a prism sight. But I think those three recommendations for red dot optics, especially if you have backup iron sights, which this gun came with, gives you a pretty good array to pick from. Thanks, TSP. Thanks, Jack. And have a blessed day.
So I've only got one little quick thing to add on that, and it has nothing to do with the content. It's more of the links. I do have the links for the Leupold, the Holosun, and the Bushnell all in the show notes. Mike mentioned that I might want to add the affiliate extension to those links, and I can't. And I just wanted you to know that I can't do it because Amazon won't let me because I don't know. Because I don't think it's because they're optics, but all three of them came up that way. Maybe it's a new policy. I've linked to other optics in the past without the problem. They all have that little message that says, you know, some items are excluded from direct affiliate linking, and this is one of them. I tried to run, sometimes when that happens, and it's weird, some of the stuff that'll show up, it'll be like a tube of epoxy or something. I'll run a search, and if I can get it to appear at the top of the search, I'll use the tracking link to the search function, and that'll work. Well, this case, no matter what I did, I could not make any one of these. It was weird. I couldn't make any one of them show up as the first or even the first or second result. And so I just used the raw links. If you want to pick one of these up and you want to make sure that I get my little piece for referring it, just remember, if you go by tspaz.com and use one of the links or any of the links there, and then no matter what you buy, you'll help us out. So that's just my little add on there. Next up, you know, we have a lot of dog people in the survival podcast community, and I don't know if it has anything to do with just how popular dogs are, or that Dorothy and I are such dog people, and maybe that's permeated through the community. We attracts like, in the words of Richard Bach. But you know, dogs are as varied as the stars in the sky, damn near. There's a dog for every purpose. There's a question came in recently. Joel will be answering this for next week, I think. And it's on choosing a bird dog. And the guy wanted as much flexibility in different types of hunting as possible. And he had down to three, and none of them were bad. But, you know, you got your retrievers, your pointers. You know, those are your two primary, and one or the other. And the one he didn't mention, and I immediately told Joel, I said, when you answer this, do whatever you want with it. But the first thing that comes to my mind is the Brittany Spaniel. And the Brittany Spaniel was literally bred to be a poacher's dog in Brittany, France. So that's where the name comes from. So it's supposed to be a dog that, you know, the poacher could use when sneaking onto King's Land and they're hunting for food. So they want a dog to be able to do all things. And so that's how much we can have specialized use of dogs. So sometimes that specialized use is something like hunting or protection, something we're going to talk about later. But sometimes it's just fitting the lifestyle. So if, for instance, if you're kind of a couch potato, and I don't even mean that in an insulting way, like you're just a chill person, you come home from work, you don't like real like high energy stuff, you know what you don't want? You don't want a young Jack Russell Terrier. That dog is high energy and it needs an outlet for its energy. So sometimes it's just about matching the dog to the lifestyle. You know, that person that's kind of older themselves, moves a little slower, whatever, might be really not even worried about breed, but age. Like there's so many senior pets or even middle-aged pets that need a home and everybody wants a puppy. But then there's other lifestyle things. And in this case, what we have is somebody that likes to hike. And they want a dog that's well-suited for that. And so, of course, I sent that to Joel, and here's what he had to say about it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. And today's question is from William. And essentially what he's asking is he wants to have a dog with him when he hikes. He does a lot of hiking in the Northeast. And he wants to know what type of dog he should get, how early to start it, things like that. It sounds like previously he had a Great Dane that had an injury before he got the dog. And when he started hiking with him, even a short hike would make the dog limp the next day. All right, so let's get into it. Let's first off start with what kind of dog should you get if you're looking to get a dog to be a hiking companion with you. So my recommendation would be to get something in the medium to like medium-large range. So when I say that, I mean something under 100, maybe 120 pounds max, depending on the breed, down to about 45 pounds, something like that. The other thing I'd be really interested in is I would want a dog that has pretty good stamina and pretty good agility. Because depending on where you're hiking, if you're hiking somewhere where it's pretty much flat or just slight inclines, well-groomed trails, things like that, your agility is not going to be quite as important in those situations. But if you're up in the mountains and you have any spots where even for a short period of time it can be really sketchy, you definitely want a dog that has good obedience and good agility. The worst thing that can happen is you're trying to get your dog to do something, they're either unsure of themselves or your obedience is poor and they end up moving or doing something that causes themselves to fall and get injured or that causes you to fall and get injured. So I highly recommend having a dog with pretty decent agility and a dog that is obedient enough that you can direct them around in some of those sketchier areas on some of the paths that people like to hike in the mountains and things like that. I particularly, of course, like the German Shepherd, the Belgian Malinois, and the Dutch Shepherd. They all make great hiking companions. I've got a lot of female clients who have either just companion dogs or protection dogs that they hike with, and they do great in that environment. But let's talk about how young to start them and how to build them into actually hiking with you when you go out. So whether you're training a dog to run or whether you're training a dog to hike, the process is going to be very similar. So just like taking a young child and let's say they're 8, 10, 12 years old and they want to get into a sport and they're going to start learning to run, right? You might go out and run with them maybe a quarter to a half a mile the first day, and probably your pace is going to be relatively slow if you're a decent runner or a decent hiker. Now, if you want to go a little bit longer than that, whether it's a child or a young pup, you might have to pick them up and finish it off, you know, holding them so that because their legs are tired or their feet are sore or something like that. After you do this for a little while, though, you're going to be able to expect a little bit more. You're going to be able to expect a little faster pace. You're going to be able to expect a little farther distance, right? So when you're training, I recommend starting training with a pup for hiking anywhere in the 12-week-old range. So that's about 4 months, 3 to 4 months old, 12 to 16 weeks in there. And they've got enough stamina, you can start their obedience at that age, and you can start walking, right? And we might go a quarter to a half a mile. What I'm looking for is typically when you start off, especially if you're moving at a faster pace than you normally just walk around, the dog tends to get kind of excited, and they'll be a little bit out in front of you. And then you'll see as you go, pretty quickly, they'll be kind of at your side, and then in a short period after that, they're kind of behind you, and you're having to encourage them to keep up, right? Once they get to the point where I'm having to encourage them to keep up, I want to go a little farther than that because we're building stamina, right? I want to push them just a little bit. But then after, you know, maybe 2 to 5 minutes of, come on, keep up, come on, you can do it kind of stuff, and adjusting my pace as needed for the animal, then I'm going to either finish and be done, or I'm going to pick them up and take them back, and we're going to rest for the day. We'll do that 3, 4, 5 days in a row, give them a couple days break, and then we'll try and increase it a little bit the next time. So I do something like quarter to half a mile till they're used to that, then 3/4 to a full mile till they're used to that. Once you get to a mile, you can kind of push it to 2 miles, give them a little bit of time to acclimate to it, make sure you're giving them enough rest time in between, and 3 and 4. Once you hit the 4-mile-ish range with a dog, you should be able to go out and hike with them. Now, if you're a speed hiker, you're going to have to do some more training. It's kind of like being a marathoner versus going out and running 2 or 3 miles. You're going to have to continue to train them up to that. But if you hike at a pretty moderate, just a walking pace, you take breaks periodically and things like that, once your dog can kind of walk at a fast pace or a jog with you for 4 miles, they're pretty much ready to go out on the trail. Now, one other thing to keep in mind with a dog that you're hiking with is oftentimes when we're hiking, we're way out, you know, maybe miles, which is hours and hours of walk time, right? Away from anywhere that people can help us. So my high recommendation for people is have a dog that weighs, that is light enough that you can pick it up and carry it if you need to. Now, I encourage people to learn how to shoulder their dogs. If your dog has a broken leg or something like that, putting them up on your shoulders is one of the easiest ways to carry them. However, if they have like an injury where they've been impaled by something in the chest cavity or something like that, they do make essentially litters for dogs. They're like a small fabric litter that has 4 holes in it for their legs. And then there's straps that you can either hold over your shoulders or hook onto a backpack, something like that. And you can carry them out that way. So if you're going to take your dog out into the backcountry or anywhere where there's potential dangers and injuries, make sure you have a basic first aid kit for yourself for common injuries out there, and make sure that you have enough equipment that you can also take care of the dog should they become injured out there. So I hope this has been helpful for you. You want a dog that's agile, one that's got the endurance to keep up for the length of time that you're going, one that you can carry with you, and you want to do enough training with this dog that it's not only acclimated to the length of time you're going to be out and the distances you're going to be going, but also one that's obedient enough that if you're in places where there's potential fall or slip hazards, that the dog has enough control that you can give those commands, wait, don't move, while I move into this position, okay, easy, let's go, and you practice some of those things in less hazardous areas, right? Practice moving on slopes, practice jumping up and around on rocks or boulders that, you know, are maybe 10, 15 feet high, but are on the ground, so you're not going to fall 100 feet if something goes wrong, right? And also, there's other equipment you can carry with you if you're going to be out hiking that can help you raise and lower the dog and things like that. Having a good quality harness, having a 30-foot or longer long line, things like that can be very helpful if you get into some kind of sketchy areas while you're out there. Maybe we'll go into that equipment a little bit more in another segment. All right, guys, I hope this has been helpful for you. Remember, if you have a dog and you want help training it, check out caninacademy.us by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on our banner there so Jack gets credit for it. And if you're looking to get a dog for hiking or protection or companionship or lots of other things, we have puppies available. You can check those out at fortresscanine.com/puppies. We do still have companion dogs available that would move into something like this a lot faster. And then, of course, we have our protection dogs at various different levels of training. And you can check all those out at Fortress Canine. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So on the specific breeds there of German and Dutch Shepherd and the Belgian Malinois, if you're getting your dogs from Joel, I would completely agree. And not about the training and all, but the genetics and the size. I remember he had a Dutch Shepherd up in Tennessee, and that dog was probably 85 pounds. And that is a sizable animal, and that's a pretty big dog for Joel's lines. I think he's got a few that are maybe a little bit bigger, but that's getting near the top end. If you're looking at shepherds especially, and you get into these big dogs, these big frame dogs, and now my shepherd went a lot of places with us, but as he got older, it was more and more difficult. That animal weighed 140 pounds. I do not recommend a dog like that if you're going to be hiking all the time, because they probably have a predisposition for hip issues. And that size is going to make it more likely to become a problem. And then something like a repetitive mode, like hiking, where you're kind of the same speed all the time, over and over and over and over and over, and over, will probably exasperate that. The other thing is, I personally can see the value of a larger dog, especially maybe some sketchy areas, being able to get places and do things. But I would actually tend toward the other direction and go a little bit smaller, even than Joel was recommending. Maybe his bottom end would be about ideal, you know, like a 40-ish, 50-ish pounds. When I look at Bellamy, she's right at 65 pounds. That would probably work really well. She's a Malinois Shepherd cross, one of Joel's dogs. But that would be my upper end if I was doing this all the time, and I'll tell you why. All the talk he did, because I was thinking before I even listened to it, about having to carry the dog. Yeah, and I'm going to tell you, like, how older you have something to do with it, too. Like, a dog's expected, like, functional lifespan for something like this is around 10 years. It's around 10 years. I'm not saying the dog's going to die when it's 10 years old in one day. I'm saying somewhere in that 10-year mark, that dog's just not going to be able to hike anymore, at least not if you're a real enthusiast the way you want to hike. But when you're really young, if you're 25, and that means you're going to be spanning a gap here, 25 to 35, 35-year-old man at hikes is in great shape. You start to get up into your 50s, and you're trying to pick up a dog that's sore. So this isn't just hiking. This is just dogs in general. When you have to take them to the vet or something like that and they can't get in the car and you have to pick them up, and you have to do it so you don't hurt them, right, and don't hurt yourself. And that dog's like my Charlie when he was in that end stage of his life and he weighed 110 pounds. That's a lot of animal to pick up, especially when you're trying not to hurt him. You're trying not to pull your own back. You're trying to get him in the car, and you know if you hurt him, he might bite you in the face, even if you never would want him. You see what I'm saying? So kind of scaling the dog down as we age is probably a pretty good idea as well. And I'll give you a dog that I think would be fantastic for this in the right climate. Right? In the right climate. I will say it one more time. In the right climate. Siberian Husky. We owned one. His name was Lakota. A person looking at the dog that doesn't know anything about the breed would have said, that dog's 55, 65 pounds. He weighed about 45 pounds. Because they're all fluff. And when I needed to pick him up, I could just pick him up and put him wherever I wanted. And that was pretty nice. And they have the endurance. They have the adventuring. They have one problem in this mix. You know how much Joel talked about obedience? You got to put the work in. People talk about Malinois and say it's like you take a German Shepherd, teach it how to do parkour, and give it crack and ecstasy. Okay, a Siberian Husky is like you took that dog and gave it more crack and meth and ecstasy, a little bit of mushrooms and some LSD, and then just for the fuck of it, a little more meth. Like, their energy level's insane. But that dog was a great hiking companion. He was fantastic, and they have all that agility. So, but I had him here because he was already here, and I adopted him. He was already an adult when I got him. I would never bring a Siberian Husky to a place like Texas. It's just not the right climate. He did fine. It's just not the right climate for him. But dogs in that size, you know, 35 to 55 pound range with that kind of agility and energy, you know, that I think would work really well for you. And definitely make sure whenever you go anywhere with your dogs, you think about their needs from a first aid standpoint, not just your own. Because, and this is another reason I'm for a little bit smaller dog when it comes to hiking. There's no way I'd leave my dog, if he couldn't move, on the trailer without me. Right? I just wouldn't do it. And then the other side of it is that dog will force himself and injure himself further for you not to do that. So I would really think about being able to exfiltrate with the dog from a size standpoint there. All right, with that, let's go ahead and we'll talk to now Kerry Brown about, well, getting out on the trail and looking this time, though, instead of for dogs, mushrooms.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources, and today I'm going to answer a question from Larry. Larry wrote in and asked, what are some of the best ways to get started with mushroom hunting, specifically morels? Details. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and I have 6 acres of forest on my property. We have hundreds of fir, madrone, and oak trees. I recently learned that madrone are associated with morels, but I've never done mushroom foraging. Are there seasons of the year, and are they targeted by region and by species of mushroom bean? Forgive me for messing that up there. I've never done mushroom foraging. Are there seasons of the year, and are they different by region and by species of mushroom being targeted? Once I pick them, how do I store them? Any pointers to get started would help, and I appreciate your consistent and fantastic commentary. I appreciate that, Larry. So, I'm only familiar, of course, with foraging these morels here in Tennessee. So, I dug into some groups and some individuals over in the Pacific Northwest and got their input on it. And here's what I got for you. Cool thing is, you're actually in one of the best regions in North America to do this. The Pacific Northwest has multiple morel species and a really long spring window. And they are one of the safer beginner mushrooms because they're pretty distinctive, especially if you take the time to learn the key traits and don't rush. So they're a spring mushroom. In your area, here's your general window by elevation. Lower elevations, March through May. Mid elevation is going to be April through June. And your higher elevation and the mountains will be May through July. And you can think of them as tracking soil temperature more than calendar dates. When your daytime temps are 60 to 70 degrees and nights stay above 40 degrees, conditions are just right. A few warm rains followed by mild weather is kind of one of your classic triggers. And one more little practical cue here that folks told me about. When the oak leaves are about the size of a mouse's ear, that's when you start hunting. So since you're in excellent habitat with your own land, if you've got oak, madrone, old apple trees, if there's still any around, disturbed soil, and especially if you have had a controlled burn or even a wildfire, morels really like to flush out after wildfire. For your patterns, look for your south-facing slopes first. Start there early in the season. Edges of clearings, old logging tracks, and around dead or dying trees. These are going to be in the leaf litter, not in your grassy areas. And they really do blend in. So think about it as scanning for wrinkled cones that break that pattern of the leaves. Once you find one, slow down, because there's always, almost always going to be more within a few feet. Quick side note here on the mushroom hunting glasses. I don't think they're worth it. I've played around with them a little bit. Maybe it depends on your own personal visual acuity, but I think learn to look for the patterns instead, and don't necessarily worry about buying something that's kind of gimmicky. So, absolute beginner safety rules here. It's where discipline matters. Only harvest true morels. And a true morel is going to have that honeycomb cap. The cap is attached directly to the stem, and it's completely hollow inside when you slice it lengthwise. Because you do want to be able to tell them apart from false morels. That has brain-like folds instead of the honeycomb pattern. More cottony is a texture that's on the inside, and it's also chambered inside. And some of those are going to be toxic. So, bottom line, if it's not hollow and clean inside, leave it. So, early on, photograph and verify everything as you go. Cross-check that with at least a couple of field guides, and even better, find out who in your region is doing ID, is holding these walks. So, I tend to go with somebody more experienced than me, and well-established in that, and a couple of full-color field guides. If you want to kind of stack your methods and learn a little bit faster, join your local mycological society. Up there, there's going to be plenty of them. Just do a search. There's going to be more than enough to join, even if you're in one of the more rural areas. Join one of the spring forays, a guided foray out into public lands. When you are gathering, carry a small brush and a mesh bag. The concept is that you are continuing to spread spores while you're kind of hunting around. And for your field guides, get one that is specific to your region, not just like a generic North America one. And as you know, a suggestion as a mindset, perhaps treat your first year as training, not harvesting, so that you can really build that pattern recognition. So when you go to pick them, you want to cut or pinch at the base. Don't yank the whole thing out. You want to keep that root mass intact. And like I said, use that mesh bag. It doesn't naturally always seed the forest, but it definitely doesn't hurt. Brush off any dirt in the field. That'll also keep more spores in its environment and keep them dry. So once you have harvested, best way to hang on to these and keep them fresh is to loosely put them in a paper bag in the fridge. Some people just wrap them up in a paper towel, and you've got about 3 to 5 days max stored. Don't put them in plastic. They will rot and get slimy and gross on you very fast. If you do want to store them long term, slice them, air dry, or use a dehydrator, and then store them dried in airtight jars. Dry morels really do keep for years, and they rehydrate really well. I haven't personally experimented with a freeze dryer, but might be something to look at if you have one or if you know somebody who runs one. They are not intended to be eaten raw. You do want to cook them. So while we're talking about cooking, I'm not going to go real deep into this, but the best ones that I've had, butter, salt, gentle heat, that's all. Morels have a really good flavor, so don't throw a bunch of sauce and season them on them the first time. Just try them the way nature made them. So look at what groups are gathering in your region. I did a quick search to grab some names here. There are quite a few. So Leah Bendlin is one who comes really well recommended. Rebecca Lexa. There are societies, the Puget Sound Mycological Society, the Oregon Mycological Society, Cascade, Mycological Society in the Eugene area, lots of stuff around Seattle. So reach out to those groups, and, you know, I understand if you don't want to have somebody out to your land, but if you want to join a group, you can kind of get a start on that pattern recognition. And, yeah, write us back. Let me know how it goes. You've got plenty of time to get ready for it. So I hope it's successful. And, yeah, let us know.
I'm going to say by cooking them. I only ever did this one time. It was pretty exceptional. I was with some friends, and they had really wanted to get their hands on some morels during the season, and they just didn't really get any. So they ended up buying some that were dehydrated, and we were doing steak and mushrooms and some other things. And they said, well, what do you think we should do with them? I said, let me try something here. So I basically rehydrated them with a really good red wine. It was a Cabernet. And then I did them, you know, once they were rehydrated, then they were sauteed with butter, a little bit of garlic and salt on the frond from the steak. So we did the steaks in pans, and then we cooked the mushrooms second. That was pretty freaking good. It's making me hungry to think. And it was about 15 years ago, and I'm thinking about the way that tasted now. I'm wondering why I never did it again. Just a thought there. Next up, we're going to talk about something called an ice dam and why you should give a damn about an ice dam. And, well, why are we talking about it? Because, well, we just had some ice damming happening in some damning ways. With all that in mind, here's Antonio Gatto.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I'm always happy to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvements and real estate. Due to the recent snowstorm that we received approximately 3 weeks ago, for the past couple of weeks, I've received many calls, emails, and messages from people all over the Western PA area expressing their concern and having many questions in regards to the severe ice damming that this storm has created. So we're going to delve into that today. We're going to discuss exactly what an ice dam is, why it's a problem, and if there are any steps that we can take moving forward to help minimize the risk of them even occurring at all. And please understand that this is mostly applicable to people that live in the northeastern part of the country. If you live in the southern states, generally you do not receive enough snow accumulation, nor do the temperatures drop low enough in order for ice damming to occur. So again, this is going to be mostly targeted at people that live in the northeastern regions and also areas of the Pacific Northwest as well too. So what exactly is an ice dam? An ice dam is a ridge of ice that forms inside of your gutter system and also at the lower portion of your roof. Now, this lower portion of your roof is known as the roof eave. The reason this is a problem is because when all of the snow and ice that is above that eave, when that starts to melt and dissipate, rather than running directly off of the roof into your gutters and out through your downspouts, that water actually gets trapped directly behind that dam. And when this happens, that water has a tendency to pool there and to lay there. And in the evening hours, it refreezes. When it refreezes, it has a tendency to expand and it backs up underneath your shingles, only to be followed by increasing temperatures the next day when the sun comes out or your furnace kicks on. That ice that is underneath your shingles starts to melt, and that is what creates the classic ice damming leaks. So what can we do to help minimize this from happening at all? The first thing that we can do is very, very simple, and that is to simply clean your gutters at the end of the season. Now, the reason that this is important is simply because clean gutters discharge water exactly as they should. If you have a partially clogged gutter or a gutter that is completely clogged, that will be the first gutter to freeze as compared to a gutter that is perfectly clean. It's a very simple process to do. It should be part of your routine maintenance at the end of the season. And here in Western PA, I always advise people do it in November simply because pretty much all of the leaves are down at that point. If you do it in October, there has a tendency to still be leaves on the trees, and you may have to do it a second time in November. So that is why I always tell people, as long as you are not having any water overflow, wait until November to clean your gutters. Now, the second thing that you need to do, and this is very important as well, and that is to make sure that your gutters have the proper slope to them. So what exactly does this mean? For example, if you have a gabled roof and you have a straight run gutter on the front of your home and also one on the rear, if you are looking directly at the front of your house and your downspout is located on the right side, the left side of that gutter, you should visually see that elevated and being up higher as compared to the right, and you should see a downward slope towards the right towards that downspout. Now, the reason that this is important is because that eliminates any chances of that gutter holding water. You do not want to have your gutters level, and you certainly do not want to have a backward slope because they will be the first to freeze compared to a gutter that does have the proper slope. And this is a very easy adjustment to do. Most roofing and gutter contractors should be able to do this for you without any trouble. Again, it's a very basic adjustment, and it is very, very advantageous to have the proper slope. Now, the third thing that you can do, and keep in mind with this, though, this will only help with a light to medium snowstorm, and that is you could certainly add the gutter heater cables. Now, the reason that this only works well in a light to medium snowstorm is because those heater cables simply do not have enough heat output to be able to melt a foot of snow and ice like we received 3 weeks ago. If you get a gargantuan snowstorm, unfortunately, it just doesn't have the power to melt through ice that thick, especially if you have sub-zero temperatures or single digits, but it will certainly help you in a light to medium snowstorm. Now, there's also an aesthetic factor that comes to play into that. I personally am not a fan of how they look on a roof. I just think they're very unsightly. You can certainly leave that to your discretion if you don't mind how that looks, but even when they are installed still in a uniform manner, I just don't like the aesthetic look of them on a roof. But again, that is totally up to your discretion. And finally, you also want to make sure that you have ice and water shield that is installed along your roof eaves, in the valleys, and behind any chimneys that are coming up through the center of the roof deck. The reason that you want this is because those are the areas that are more prone to ice damming. Now, this does not mean that if you have an existing roof to tear off your shingles, to install ice and water shield along the eaves and valleys and restall shingles. What this means is if there is a new roof in your horizon within the next couple years, please just make sure that your home improvement contractor is going to be installing that in those areas, as I mentioned. And it also is code in Western PA because we are prone to ice damming. Now, a couple things to understand with ice and water shield and with a new roof. There is a big misconception out there that is that if you have ice and water shield, that is a bulletproof barrier for ice damming. This is simply not true. It certainly helps, and it helps a lot, but if you receive a very large snowstorm and the ice dams are very large in size, a new roof will still leak with ice and water shield. So remember that. That does not necessarily mean that your contractor did a bad job. That does not mean that there is something wrong. Ice dams are not considered a normal part of roofing. That is an event that occurs every so often, and when it's bad enough, again, a new roof will still leak. And another thing to keep in mind, too, if you have a roof that is halfway through its lifespan, this does not necessarily mean that you need a new roof. Again, with a very heavy ice dam, your roof will leak. Please don't be taken by a contractor that will come over and tell you, oh, you need a new roof, that's why you're having ice dam leaks, etc. Please don't fall for that. That is not true. Simply wait for the snow and ice to melt. Wait for a steady rain after that, and usually 99% of the time you will not have any issues moving forward. Now, in closing, I do have to say one thing. It has come to my attention that some people during this recent storm were actually trying to climb up on their roof with snow and ice on it. Folks, please do not do this. It is not worth a fall off of a roof that could be a potentially life-altering injury. And the other thing that you have to understand is that if you get up there with axes, chisels, and hammers, like it's apparent that some people were doing a few weeks ago, you severely run the risk of that whole gutter system collapsing, because what most people don't understand when they do this is that gutter is already under an extreme load from holding up all of that ice and snow. And if you get up there and you start pounding away, you run the risk of having that whole gutter system collapse. It is certainly not worth it. And believe me, your health and safety is way more important than water damage. And one final note on that, it's usually not discussed, and for whatever reason, and I'm not sure, but most homeowners insurance policies, they do cover ice dam damage. So again, if your damage is severe enough and you have a lot of water penetration, feel free to file an insurance claim. That's why you have homeowners insurance. But please do not get up on a steep slope roof or a two-story roof when it's covered with snow and ice. It's just a completely unnecessary risk. I hope that this episode answered all of your questions. Again, keep them coming into Jack, and he will send them to me, and I will always get back to you in a very timely manner. Enjoy the rest of the day, and remember, never stop learning. We will see you on the next episode.
For a lot of people, that's a lot of really, really, really important information. If you live in certain climates, this is stuff you need to pay attention to. Now, when this question came in, I knew what they were talking about, but it made me think of a different kind of an ice dam. I want to tell you a story of a really stupid thing government did. I believe it was 86 or 87. It was somewhere in about that timeline. We were living in Pennsylvania, and we had the blizzard of 86 or 87, whatever the hell it was. It could have even been 88. I don't know. It was somewhere in there. It snowed so much. How much did it snow? I'm glad you asked. It snowed so much that when I looked out of my house, I didn't see anything except white. It snowed so much that the storm door that was on the house wouldn't open, and we couldn't push it open, and we opened up a window, and I climbed out the window as a kid and shoveled snow off the porch because it drifted it up under the porch. That's why it had never caused a problem with the outward opening storm door before. I had to shovel enough snow out from underneath it so that we could get the door open so everybody could get out and we could snow. It snowed that much. But we were about 2.5 hours northeast of Philadelphia where we lived. Philadelphia actually got more snow that year. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70 inches of snow. Okay? 5-6 foot of snow. Which means drifts can be, and that's why it was so bad at our house, that the snow drifted straight up against the house. The wind was coming almost directly out of the south by southeast on this storm, and that just blew this snow up against our house. But down there, they got more and they got wetter snow. Our snow was really dry, which at least made it easy to get rid of. Eventually they had no place to put it, and whoever was running the city at the time decided to push it in the Schuylkill River. They pushed enough of it in there that eventually it made an ice dam, and the water is still moving and dammed up and underneath, and it flooded several neighborhoods during a warm period in all this, which then froze like a skating rink after that. And I think the people that lived in those neighborhoods wanted to lynch the mayor. So if you ever think you've heard every stupid thing government's done up till now, I'm here to tell you there's probably 1,000 more examples of something that stupid that, you know, unless you were there when it happened or happened to hear about it through a friend or something that was there, you don't even know, and nobody knows. I bet it'd be hard to even find that. Because, today if that happened, there'd be people with cameras, and it'd be on Instagram and everything, you know. But back in the 80s, we didn't have any of that shit. So I don't know if you could find anything about it at all. I just wonder how many dumb things the government did. That makes me think of another dumb one they did. Remember this one? Remember the whale? That one I know you can find. If you want to find it, look up Town Blows Up Whale on YouTube. That should get you to find it. This giant whale washed up on shore, and they decided to blow it up. And so they brought out blasting guys. They put a whole bunch of explosives on this whale, and they thought they were going to blow it to pieces and go out to sea and the seagulls and fish and eat it. Well, they set it off, and the whole town came out to see it, and slabs of whale the size of cars flying through the air, and of course that's a lot of blubber, and that's so it came down not only crushing things and stinking, but on fire like whale napalm. And eventually they realized, well, that didn't work, because as much flew up in the air, the whale itself is so big it looked like nothing happened. And so they brought in a bunch of heavy equipment, dug a really deep hole, and shoved it in there and buried it, which is what they should have done in the first place. So there's two things government really did that are really stupid. Maybe we'll do a show someday, the dumbest things government ever did, but keep it that way. Keep it light. Like, you know, experimenting with communism would be like number one with the dumbest things. But what if we just talk about the really, like the thing that anybody looks at and goes, you know what? You know, Forrest Gump would go, Mama says stupid is as stupid does, like that. I bet you we could crowdsource that and come up with some really good stuff. All right, moving on. Let's talk about propane and propane products, right? Seriously though, you don't have natural gas service, so you need a big old propane pig. I mean, a big one. Well, do you lease it or do you buy it? And what are the ups and downs of that? And why should you make the choice you should make?
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a cold, so bear with me with my voice. Hopefully we'll get through this together. But I've got a question from Larry, and his question is specifically about propane tanks. Yes. What are the pros and cons about owning a large propane tank versus leasing one? His details are that he bought a property that had a 39-year-old heat pump and decided to replace it with a propane assist furnace. And let me stop before I go on, because I really like propane assist furnaces, and people might not know what this is. So typically when you have a heat pump as your source of heat for your home, the auxiliary heat or the extra heat or the assist heat is going to be resistive electric coils, which are very inefficient, very expensive to run, but oftentimes the only choice if you don't have a fuel to burn. And so what Larry's actually done here is he's taken the two concepts and put them together. So a heat pump at certain temperatures as it gets cold will heat your house at a reasonable cost, and it really reduces cost, and it's higher efficiency than the resistive electric heat. And then if the heat pump can't keep up, which a heat pump is basically just a air conditioner running backwards, if that heat pump can't keep up, then the system turns on with the resistive coils. In Larry's case, what he's doing is he's putting in a propane system so that if the temperature gets too cold for the heat pump to keep up and work efficiently, then the propane assists that heat pump, rather than the propane being the primary heating source for the house. This allows you to use a fuel that's more efficient, because it's burning and putting off that heat, like a propane or other services, natural gas, things like that, to heat your home while not using a ton of propane, which is more expensive because you have to get it trucked out. You have to have a tank. You'd have to have considerations for much larger tanks if it was your primary heating source. So, all that said, I really like this idea of a propane assist furnace. Larry has decided on a 500-gallon tank that, and he found more than 10 companies in areas that offer. That's awesome, because you have competition, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. He found that a recertified tank would be between $2,500 and $4,500, and that a leased tank for installation fees would be between $450 and $1,600 in fees to get that on his property. He also notes that the leased cost per gallon when he fills, he's got an extra 20 cents per gallon to an extra dollar per gallon above what it would cost to fill a tank that he owns. And that's part of how these companies get their money back on their lease. And he concluded that the ROI on owning a tank would be about 20 to 50 years. He said, unless he takes the tank in each time to get it filled up, if he's willing to transport it. Now, my recommendation is do not transport a tank, because then you have to, you're transporting a giant potential explosive. Yes, they have a lot of safety measures on them, but there's no point in doing that. I don't think that the effort involved there would be worth it, and I don't think that the safety risk would be worth it either. So I wouldn't bother transporting, but there are some other ways you can consider getting your ROI faster or getting a better deal on the lease tank. So let's start with that. On a leased tank, you could call between companies, because you have 10 companies in the area, especially with the smaller, maybe mom and pop type companies, you could work between them and say, well, this company offered me this deal and I'd rather go with you, but, you know, can you get me a better deal on the install, or can you reduce the install fee or even eliminate the install fee? Because some of these companies will do the installation for the leasing for free, which can really increase the benefit to having a leased tank. So let's go through some of the pros and cons of owning your own tank. owning your own tank obviously allows you to switch between companies easily for best price or faster service. So it's not just about price, it's also about service. You may have one company that can't get to you for a couple of weeks because you're going through a cold snap and everybody needs propane, and another company might be able to get to you later today. So consider that there is a pro in that in being able to for them to get to you more quickly. There's often minimum buying requirements for a leased contract. So if you go through a mild winter and your heat pump gets you the whole way through and you don't use any propane, there's still a minimum buying requirement on your contract in most cases for these leased tanks. Another pro for owning your tank is its lower cost per gallon. So anywhere from 20 cents less per gallon to a dollar less per gallon, depending on the company. You get more control over the placement. If you're leasing a tank, they're going to be more specific about where it gets placed. And you can raise the sales price of the property by having a tank on site. So if you're ever thinking you're going to sell your property, having the tank and that not being taken away when the property changes hands can be a selling point. As far as cons on owning your own tank, any provider can choose to refuse filling a tank. And they don't even really have to give you a good reason for it. And so you could have providers who refuse to fill the tank. Now, with 10 providers or companies in the area, I wouldn't be as concerned about that because they're going to be kind of fighting with each other for business, and that's a good thing for you. So another con to owning your own tank is what we already talked about, which is that if you can get the leasing companies fighting with each other to give you the best price, you could actually drive your price way down, which could really increase the number of years it takes you to hit that ROI. Another con of owning your own tank is that you're responsible for repairs and maintenance. Now, these big tanks don't need the, every 5-year certification that the DOT or the little grill tanks do, but they do require some maintenance and some looking after as well. And the final con, and we kind of talked about this already, is that your ROI is going to be longer on the bought tank. So it's going to take a while to pay it off, even if you're able to negotiate some of these things. So, Larry, I hope that helps you make a decision and it doesn't just muddy the waters a bit more for you. Feel free to reach out to me via email if you have any more questions. Thanks, everybody, and have a great week.
Good question and an even better answer. Now let's talk about dogs again, but this time we're going to talk about, if I get me one of these really fancy, expensive protection dogs from somebody like Joe Riles, which, by the way, in spite of the numbers you're about to hear from Matt, just double the cost for like a fully trained dog, can I deduct that from my income tax if I have a home-based business and I have the dog for security? Matt's going to give a very involved, very accurate, very lawyer-like answer that I completely agree with. But then I'm going to give you just one way of thinking that can change calculus, but it still probably does have to do with what kind of business are we talking about and how much money do you make? And that's going to be a key part of this here. Let's go ahead and hear from Matt first, and then I'll give you my follow-up.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Cercely with Agorist Tax Advice coming to you to answer another listener question. And frankly, I love this question. This is a fun one. Can the purchase of a protection dog and its training from a professional like Joel Riles be a business write-off? If so, is that a one-time thing or over time? Additional details. I went to ChatGPT and asked if a purchase like this can be a business expense and write it off. It said that it would be considered, quote, extremely rare, unquote. So I got more specific and stated that I personally could never justify spending that type of money on a pet. However, because I have a home-based business with equipment and inventory to protect, I might consider a guard dog. So is this the type of thing that would trigger an audit since it's rare? So I'm going to actually disagree with even the premise of ChatGPT here. It's not extremely rare to buy a guard dog. It is extremely rare for a pet to be deductible because pets are never deductible. A pet is always a personal expense that is not deductible. And that even when you have it for personal use, if it's medical, a service animal, it can be deductible as a medical expense, but it's still a personal expense, never a business expense. But there are many, many, many working animals that are deductible for business use. Livestock guardian dogs, herding dogs, security guard dogs, and even some service animals in a business context. For example, if you're a therapy place and you have animals for people to pet and cuddle with as part of calming them down, that could be legitimate. It's no different than a cow or a pig used in a business. So the real question isn't really even, is this rare? The question is this dog an ordinary, reasonable, and necessary expense for your business? And then can you prove that it's for your business? Now, let's talk ordinary and necessary in plain English. Most people think that the phrase means everybody does it, or almost everybody does it. But that's not it. Ordinary just means normal or common in your line of work, or at least not really weird for a business in your line of work to do. Necessary is helpful or appropriate for the business, not absolutely required for survival, but it's also not just vibes. Basically, if it helps you make money, market, or avoid losing money, say the theft, it can be necessary. Now, the other thing the IRS looks at is whether it's reasonable. If it looks like you buy yourself a luxury lifestyle item and you slap business on it, you're begging for trouble. So I don't know what your business is. I don't know how much you make. If you buy a $25,000 trained dog from Joel Riles and your business makes $100,000 a year or $50,000 a year, that's going to be really hard to defend unless there's a very specific fact pattern. Like you have $500,000 of equipment and inventory in your home, or you run a home-based precious metal business with regular cash pickups, or you've had threats and you have legitimate security needs. But if you're making $1 million a year, that $25,000 dog is going to look very reasonable, especially if you have any real security needs, valuable inventory, expensive tools, customers who come on the property, if you're in a high-risk area. That looks like a normal security expense. It's not automatic, but it's going to pass the smell test. It's not going to wave any red flags, and you have an excellent chance to win it if the IRS challenges. So you want to build up your argument by being credible. You have business assets that are actually worth protecting. There's a real risk profile based on location, hours, cash, inventory. Prior incidents would be a big thing. If somebody has broken into your place before and stolen stuff, then security is much more justifiable. A big question is, where is the dog? Is it always in the business area, or is it sleeping on your kid's bed at night and hanging out with you in the kitchen when you're not working? Did you take the steps that look like a professional security plan, not a toy purchase? Did you evaluate other options for security? Now, by the way, if you already have a business where you have armed security on site, then I think you're going to win this fight every time, because it's just another alternative to having guys with guns on your property. If it's unarmed security, it's going to be a little dicier. But if you're paying somebody $50,000 or $100,000 a year to guard your place, buying a dog to make them better, I think, again, you're very likely to win that, assuming it's appropriate. Now, generally, you're going to be able to deduct the full purchase price of the dog all at once under Section 179. There are exceptions to that, but usually you can do it all at once. Even if you can't, the training can be deducted all at once, and then just the dog value would be depreciated over typically 5 years. Now, it's going to be a one-year deduction, but also your cost of maintaining the dog will be a deduction. The food, the medical care, ongoing training, those will all also be business expenses. So the other thing we need to look at is there personal use and business use? And some of this is, I'm being a lawyer and it may not matter that much because how are they going to prove it? But on something that could be a little bit iffy, this does actually get important. So if this is a home-based business and the dog lives in the home, that's mixed-use problem. Even if you just say, well, it's a guard dog for the home, well, your home's not the business. It doesn't kill the deduction, but it means maybe you can only depreciate some percentage of the cost of the dog. So documentation is going to matter here if the IRS challenges it. Does the dog have a defined role? It lives in the security shop or in the backyard to guard the inventory. Do you have business signage and policies, visitor procedures, working dog on premises signs, etc.? Do you have a written security plan of why you need the dog, what you're protecting, and what else you're doing to protect it? If you want to be extra safe, you also, and this is not directly a tax thing, but it will help you in the tax fight, make sure you talk with your insurance that you add the dog to your insurance. So if it bites anybody, you're covered. But also the very fact that you go through your business insurance to insure the dog, well, that looks a lot like a business thing. Finally, optics are going to matter on this one. They shouldn't, but they do. If you name the dog Snuggles and you let it sleep in the kid's bed, then that's not going to help you if the IRS comes after you. Now, to the last question, does this trigger an audit because it's rare? I don't think so. Now, first of all, it won't be obvious. You're not going to tell the IRS you bought a dog. You're going to tell them on your tax forms that you spent money on security and on training. Now, maybe at some point you'll throw in food for the dog, but that's going to be a very small number. It's not going to be the type of red flag that's going to cause an audit. What is going to maybe happen is if you have never spent a dollar on security before in your business's life and now you suddenly drop 25 grand, that could be a bit of a red flag. Watch out for that. But rare is not an audit trigger. What matters is not being sloppy, not being greedy, and having good documentation. By the way, be prepared to explain in one sentence why it's a business expense without making it up. So here's a bad example. I brought a protection dog because my home-based business has tools. That's not a great story. Much better. I operate a welding business on my property with $200,000 in equipment and inventory. Customers regularly come by my home. They're there after hours. There have been burglaries on my property before, and this dog is a trained working protection animal used to secure the shop area and manage premises safety. So, bottom line, pets, not deductible. Working animals usually are, including security dogs, if they're ordinary, reasonable, and necessary. The dog maybe can be deducted over time, maybe can be all at once. You have some options there. And I don't think this is a huge audit risk if it really is useful, reasonable, and necessary for your business. Final thing, you mentioned ChatGPT. I love AI. I use AI to do work in my business. But I'm going to be blunt. Chatbots are great to give you ideas, but they're not going to defend you. If you want to do this right and treat it like a serious deduction, you probably want to talk to a CPA or an attorney about the actual documentation, the actual facts, and setting up a position to make sure you can win this fight. Now, everybody, hope you like this. If you want to reach out to me, you can reach me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a great download there with a whole toolkit to help you document your life and save money on taxes. Have a great week.
To that last bit about having the answer ready, and the answer that he came up with was outstanding. And I know I said in the intro you should memorize it. Well, you shouldn't memorize it, but if you're going to do anything, like it might not have nothing to do with a dog, you understand what I'm saying? Anything in this realm of it's a deduction and I can legally justify it, but it's a little bit questionable, that is the kind of answer you should have prepared immediately. Like, you should know that answer before you make the call, and it should be committed to memory. I'll agree with that. I just want to throw out a concept here that may or may not work. I mean, I would run this by my tax attorney and my CPA before I did it. I'm just going to throw this concept out. Sometimes calling something something different and sometimes simply changing the way something's billed for changes everything about it. So what if you were buying a dog from somebody like Joel Riles and you signed a contract to lease the dog for security purposes? And you lease the dog with a lease-to-purchase option over a period of, let's say, 5 years, which I think an asset at a value of like 50 grand, you'd kind of have to depreciate it anyway. But there's new things with accelerated depreciation. I don't know if a security would qualify for that or what. But let's hear out what I'm saying here. It would work like this. The dog is part of a security package from Joel, which includes things like consulting and what have you. And it's, you know, for round numbers, it's $9,000 a year, which is a completely reasonable number for security on a business that is worth even thinking about this, okay? It's completely reasonable. If that's not a reasonable number for your business, you shouldn't even be thinking this way. What are you trying to do? Get enough of a negative? You see what I'm saying? Like, you have to make some money for this to work at all. But by the contract on the, say, fifth year or sixth year, then if you make all your payments, then it transfers to a purchase agreement where then you buy the dog. And you're going to end up then buying the dog for about $5,000 final payment, which would probably not be deductible because the dog would then become personal property, and you would probably be at least considering a new dog soon after that. Maybe not right away. Again, dogs like this have, you know, functional working lives of about 9 to 11 years, 12 on the outside. Yeah. So now you've changed it from a asset to a service. Of course, your service provider then gets the money and has to bill you, invoice you, and report that income, but they have to do that anyway. It might be a creative way for someone in that line of work or a similar line of work to create a more affordable way into a product. But, you know, there's risk there for the provider, like what happens when you don't pay and things like that. But it just and I'm saying it that way for the purpose of making you think differently, because let me explain to you, it might not even be taxes. Here's a perfect example of how changing what you call something and how you bill something changes everything. So one of the companies I used to help run and had some ownership in was a company called Sirian, and we did optimization services for wireless networks, cellular networks, telling companies things like where they needed to upgrade, when they needed to upgrade, how long they could defer that capital expenditure. So this is millions, and for the providers, we're talking about billions of dollars. Tens of billions of dollars per unit. So even if you have to spend the same money deferring a $10 billion expenditure till next year because you can, worth a lot of money to them. So we did about $4 to $6 million a year with AT&T as an example. Well, one year they wanted to buy a bunch more service from us, but really they were buying a product, which was the software. Now, the software came, this is long before everybody was using the term software as a service, okay? This is back about 2005, 6, somewhere in that range, before I even started the show. And they were like, they were on board, and they wanted to buy, like, the next generation and all the stuff that went with it and all. And the problem was, they wanted it now, but from a standpoint of material expenditure, capital material expenditure, they were out of budget for the year. We were getting towards, so it was going to be a couple months and they would have the money in a good day, but they needed to do the work now. And, but what the sales team had done is written the whole contract up so what the, like 80% of the cost was the software itself. So all we did was change that and basically said, you don't own the software. It's our software. The whole thing's a service. And that allowed them to use the service side of their budget, which they had still quite a bit of money in. So even though they had the money, it wasn't in the right class. We just changed the classification of the billing. And I'm telling you, Our we had a president of that company. Even though I had ownership, I was not the president. I mean, the president of that company, she was a Stanford grad, and we had a salesman. He was a really sharp dude, really sharp. Both of them insisted this would not work. Can't do that. You can't. I said, why don't you ask your customer? And they didn't want to do it, so I got on a conference call. I got on with them. I proposed to the guy. He goes, I don't see any problem with that. Can you do that? I'm like, we can call it, whatever. He goes, oh, hell yeah, let's go. It was a five-minute phone meeting that resulted in a contract of a bit over $1 million. So I just want you to be able to think that way. Not necessarily that's the answer there, But sometimes simply what you call a thing changes everything. We had a farm back when we did Permit Ethos thing. The partners were trying to get insurance for the farm. They kept telling the insurance company it was a permaculture farm. Nobody could understand that. And I just said, tell them it's an organic farm. Because it doesn't matter. Tell them it's a farm. It doesn't matter. So somebody said, well, it's a farm. That ended everything, and we got the insurance policy. It was no big deal at that point. Be careful what words you use and how you use them, especially when dealing with people like the IRS and any other contract. That's why you should seek the services of a Matthew Sersley, because he may email me after this and go, Jack, that's brilliant. Or, Jack, no, do not effing do that, right? So I don't know yet. I would always, yeah, this is the thing. You come up with these kind of edgy ideas, and then you take them to professionals like Matthew, and they say, no, don't do that. Yeah, do that, or you can do that, but you better do this first or document it this way first. There you go. All right, so now let's talk about, to me, this is like a master class, right? This is like a master class on sustainable protein production. Let me just read you the email, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit, and we'll wrap up. So Ward sends this. Jack, more connections here in the world. I've been getting black soldier flies for a couple years to feed my quail and speed up composting. This all happened by chance. It all started when I started saving a lot of used coffee grounds from work. 5 gallons every 4 to 6 weeks. Found soldier flies like it and knew they were just helping break it down, so I encouraged them and feed handfuls to my quail. Things go slow in winter because I do not go that extra step of giving them a temperature like they like in the winter, but winter's short here in lower Alabama. I'm going to talk about lower Alabama here in just a second. And I came across this and thought you would enjoy it. It's a link to an article called Restoring the Soil of Baldwin County. I do have a link for that. He said, now if we can just stop them from cutting down forests to build solar farms, we'll be better off for a bit. From Ward, lower Alabama. First lower Alabama thing. I can remember this dude's voice like it was yesterday, and I was barely 18 years old. I had to join the Army that summer. I turned from 17 to 18, and we had this guy in basic training. His name was Yates. Now, he talked with a southern drawl that would just curl your eyes. I mean, it was deep southern drawl and kind of a little, I can't really do it because it's higher pitched than I'm capable of with it. And one day, one of the drill sergeants said, Yates, where the hell are you from? You know? And Yates goes, Drill Sergeant, I'm from Lower Alabama. No, Drill Sergeant, I'm from L.A. What? This drill sergeant, big old dude, man, he goes, what did you say? Drill Sergeant, I say I'm from L.A. What the hell are you talking about, soldier? Where are you from? What do you mean, L.A.? He goes, Lower Alabama, Drill Sergeant. And I can still remember that. I can also tell you this dude's last four of his Social Security number. Don't worry, it's not security breach. I don't know the rest of it, right? So when you're in the military today, your Social Security number is like your serial number. Like when my granddad was in, you had an actual serial number, a service number that was different than that, okay? But it became, and I don't know when, it went to where the military, it might have been after Roosevelt, and there actually was a Social Security number, I don't know. But at some point it became that. So when we were lining up for chow, this is something that is regulated. Everybody thinks you're in the military, you get food. And when you're in basic, you kind of do, but it has to be accounted for because when you go to permanent party, which is like your regular duty station, some people actually get money instead of chow. So if they want to go to the chow hall, they actually have to pay. So they get a card. So they have to keep a record of it. The way they did in basic back then anyway was they just tied it to your last warrior social, your name, your last name, and your social. Yates was Yates. 8905 Drill Sergeant. I'm telling you, that dude's voice was so specific. I can hear it, and I can remember that number, which is now more than, it's almost 40 years. It's like 35 and change years, and I can still remember. I probably have Alzheimer's someday and not remember shit. I was like, what's Yates's last four? 8905. Anyway, nothing to do with any of that. All right, so here's my thought on this. First of all, this dude's getting a 5-gallon bucket every 4 to 6 weeks. That's not even that much. It sounds like a lot, but that's not even that much. At that amount, he's probably working in an office where there's like, you know, a coffee maker for a few people. and he's probably just taken over managing the waste stream, whether he's actually making the coffee to make sure it happens or just, hey guys, I'll put this bucket here is for the coffee grounds only, and has an office full of adults that can do it. Because when I think back to like where I was working when this all started, when I first started the show back in 2008, we had three companies that were all part of a conglomerate that I was part of, but they were all sharing the same floor of a building. And we had one, even though we had some in some different areas of the building, we had one break room for all the companies. And with that, I mean, we were looking at about 65 people that worked in the building in an office environment. We went through probably more coffee than that in every 2 or 3 days. And so just that waste stream, if handled properly, could have been massive amounts of compostables and, in this case, black soldier fly feed. And the way to close this loop, too, for our buddy Ward here in L.A., in Lower Alabama, would not necessarily be to heat the soldier flies through the winter, but to make more of them and to put the surplus on ice. And that way you can freeze them and you still have food through your winter time. And there's no reason a person could not be running a really productive quail system, you know, something with, let's say, two cages, 4 to 5 females and one male per cage, and some reserve males in case your male gets killed by your girls, because sometimes that happens in a separate cage. And then, you know, processing meat and eggs and not feed almost 100% of the diet from this. Now, you want to take it to another level. You have your black soldier fly farm, and then you have your earthworm farm, your red wigglers, right, your compost worms. You take the frost from the black soldier fly into the earthworms. You let them process it a second time. Everything about black soldier frass is good fertilizer. Running it then through an earthworm makes it better. And everybody I've talked to who does this has said the difference in the fertility yield per pound applied goes up hugely. And it's bigly, right? And it's not just because it's now worm casting. So you compare worm castings to frost, and they're pretty similar. You process frost into worm castings, and you get even better results. You also get another product in earthworms, which I've never fed an earthworm to a quail. I cannot imagine that they wouldn't eat it. And earthworms, all you need to do is keep that shit from freezing solid, and you can produce those all winter. So then you have another, you know, you have that product, but you also have like fish food as well. Like, there, how many things could we really produce from garbage alone? And in this case, one form of garbage. But Jack, I don't work in an office environment where there's that much coffee to harvest. There's no way we drink 5 gallons of coffee a month at home, at least in coffee grinds or whatever. Oh, God, so you know what you drive past every day is about 100 coffee shops, and all of them produce more grinds than you could imagine per day. And almost any of them, I've walked into Starbucks, and here's the way. Hey, do you guys ever save coffee grinds for gardeners, whatever? And usually today they say, oh no, we don't do that. Can I get some though? Can you do that for me? Oh shit, you just want some? And they'll go get a garbage bag. This is the one thing you know. It's going to be heavy as F. And why? Because it's wet. But I have never asked and been told, get out of here. And if I did get told to get out of here, I'd just go back a different time when different people were working to the same place and probably get them. Or just go across the street to another one. This is a waste stream that has so much potential. You can grow mushrooms, you can grow soldier flies, you can make compost, you can grow earthworms. I mean, it's just it is a perfect application of permaculture design science to, instead of making a new expenditure, instead of coming up with something completely new and complex, to look at existing systems, find a waste stream, intercept the waste stream, and turn waste into productive output. And so, you know, if you look around, there's a lot of ways to do that. The people that look around and find, like, that make biochar, and they find, let's say, a cabinet maker. Those guys have tons of cutoffs. All you do is just go by their shop or send them an email, give them a phone call. And I've had better luck with stuff like this by going to see somebody. But a lot of the cabinet makers tend to be like little small private shops. So they do custom cabinet work. They're generally not production level. That all is still imported. So, but with those guys, usually, if you call them, a lot of them, especially, they're older guys that are in that business. And they're bigger on talking to people than they are on text messages and emails. If you call them up and say, hey, I'm so-and-so, I saw where your shop is, I live right down the road from you, I'll come by, you know, once a month and pick up all your cutoffs if you'll save them for me. They don't have to take care of it. It's a waste stream they have to get rid of, and a lot of them have to pay to do it. Even if they have a place they can dump it, they have to take the time to do it. I've talked to one guy. He was burning it. He's one making biochar. He's throwing them in a 50-gallon drum about every 2 weeks. Goes out, fill the drum up, pour a little bit of fuel on it, set it on fire, walk away. Well, he said, how's it different? And I told him, he said, well, shit, yeah, you can have it. Because even though that's all I'm doing, I don't have to do that. So there's how many places like that are there where we can find and intercept waste streams? So great, there you've got products in biochar and like biochar that is part of a compost. Then you've got compost, you've got a protein feed source either to fish or to birds, right? And then you've got a fertility yield, and that's with two waste streams. And that would be the foundation of a small business. Now, not one I think you could justify writing off a $50,000 security dog for, but you get what I'm saying. We need to think more like this in our daily lives. With that, we've wrapped everything up, and I want to remind you, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the optics, that you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is one I brought to you many times in the past, but it's been a while since I brought it around, and it featured in a video I did today. It's the BN Link 24-hour mechanical timer. These things are great. They're stupid easy to use. They basically have little pins on them you push down. Not the ones you pull it out and reinsert it, just push it down, pop it up. It's super simple. Each one's 15 minutes. So if you wanted something to run for 15 minutes, from 1 to 1:15, you push down that one, you turn it and set the time, plug it in, and it works. That's it. I use it a lot in things like aquaponic systems, because if I want something to once an hour run an ebb and flow cycle, I set up the pump, I put every fourth one down, right? Set the time. Don't even have to set the time for that, but I usually do. Walk away and it's done. If I want lights to come on and off for plants to grow, let's say 12 hours a day, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., push all of those pins down, plug it in, walk away. I mean, really that easy. A lot of times timers are a pain in the ass. These things are stupid easy. They're about $8 a piece. So I highly recommend it. Other items of the day this week, just a reminder, the Vivor chamber vacuum sealer, that thing's on sale for $330. That will pay for itself in the savings of bags over like $100. The Food Saver, right? And it just does a way better job, and it does things that the Food Saver type ones can't do, and the bags cost about half the price. The Anker Soundcore V20i over-the-ear headphones, like I said, someday they're going to discontinue them. Get them now if you want them. The next would be the Temp Pro TP50 digital hydrometer and thermometer I bought yesterday that keeps track of the temperatures and humidity in an area that you want to. They're about $10 a piece. They can be less if you buy them like a 3-pack. It also records, since the last time you reset it, what was the highest and lowest humidity and what was the highest and lowest temperature. Nick Ferguson looked at those yesterday and said, hey, I want you to know, I spent a little bit more, a couple dollars more per unit. Mine are Bluetooth. They work with an app and it tracks everything. I'll probably bring that to you next week. I don't need them, but I want you guys to know about stuff like that. That's really cool. Anyway, guys, I really appreciate it. Again, I want to remind you, Nick Ferguson is expecting baby. We hope he gets his baby soon. That baby girl Ferguson, and Like you said, divers aren't going to buy themselves. So if you've been thinking about picking up some plants to get in the ground this spring, do him a favor and do yourself a favor. Get over to Rare Plant Store. There's a link for the Oak Bonanza today for the Oak Tree package, but he's got a bunch of cool stuff. Easy to remember, rareplantstore.com. Take care, guys. That'll do the weekend. It is now time for me anyway, a three-day weekend. For everybody else, a normal weekend. I'll catch you Monday with a brand new show. Here's some looks at what's going to be coming up next week. One, Nick Ferguson will be on to talk about fodder trees and oak support trees and overstory and forest farming and all that good stuff. Two, I'm going to do a show next week, probably Tuesday, on all the things that you can grow and regrow from produce in the grocery stores, whether it be Publix or Albertsons or really cushy foo-foo places like Whole Foods or Central Market or what have you. Some stuff works really good. Some stuff gets touted as being more than it is on stupid little viral videos, but it can still be useful if you know what you're doing with it. And there's some stuff that I'll cover I bet you've never heard before. What are we going to do with the other days? Well, one will be an expert council show, but the other one, one more day next week. I don't know. Might be a Newsday Tuesday type thing, or current events. Who knows what will happen in the next 3 days? Or it might just be another kind of standalone how to do something to make your life better show. With that, guys, take care. I appreciate all of you. I'll catch you on Monday with another episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.